I Hate Politics is a podcast dedicated to exploring a human activity we love to hate. We look at human life, culture, economics closest to us, in our neighborhoods, workplaces, schools and streets, and in our local governments. Together, we'll explore how politics is central to getting things done in societies where we treasure diverse views and preferences. I'm Sunil Dasgupta. I've spent my life studying politics, and I know this. Unless we want to live in a dictatorship or a monarchy, we are stuck with politics. Politics is more than just Trump, Biden, or elections. It's how we fix potholes, make our streets safer, where we put our schools, and decide who goes to them. It's about coming together as a community. It's about us. Let's go find those stories. My guest in this episode is Dan Reed, urban planner by trade and author of a mighty local blog called Just Up the Pike. Dan lives in Silver Spring, where he joined his neighborhood association and became the chair of the association's planning and zoning committee. The neighborhood where he lives is 70% non-white. But there were almost no persons of color in the neighborhood association itself. When he pointed this out, he got this response, and I quote, "Dan, I turned 80 years young. I've been a neighborhood resident since 1973, almost 50 years. This is a civic association, not a left-wing promotion society. I hope you would welcome a bit of diversity from those who don't think your way and stick to appropriate subjects. My own personal experience with the PTA has been similar. My children's schools are more than 50% Latino, but it is hard to find a PTA officer who is not white. I've often been the only non-white person at PTA meetings and certainly on the PTA side of meetings with school and county officials. Neighborhood associations, HOAs, PTAs, and other volunteer organizations have long been seen as the first step in the ladder of American democracy. But as Robert Putnam pointed out in his 1999 book, Bowling Alone, association life in America has been in decline since the 1970s. Putnam blamed television, an exogenous technological shock. But Dan Reed is a more astute observer and sees the problem as endogenous to neighborhood associations, PTAs, and volunteer organizations. A renter has little incentive to join a neighborhood association because the organization is primarily concerned with upholding property values, which isn't of primary interest to the renter. The same parent who doesn't show up at PTA meetings will travel 2 hours one way to take their child to a soccer game. One PTA president I know personally repeatedly says that she doesn't want the job, but she couldn't find someone else to step up over several years as PTA president in successive elementary, middle, and high schools. We have known about time constraints people have for civic engagement since the advent of public choice theory in the 1950s. So how did people find time then? We have to look deeper at those organizations and who they serve. Later in the episode, Andrew Saundry also takes off after Putnam to examine how diversity and a sense of community affect Up County. But first, the news roundup. This was a policing-heavy news week. Maryland General Assembly passed a set of police reform and accountability bills with veto-proof majority setting the stage for an overhaul of public safety in the state. In particular, the bills addressed when and how police officers can use force and establishes greater civilian oversight and transparency in how police officers are disciplined. The use of force provisions emphasizes conflict resolution over forceful escalation and imposes criminal penalties for excessive use of force. Police shootings will be investigated by an independent body outside the police department. On the oversight and transparency side, public information laws were opened to allow greater public access, and the law enforcement Officers' Bill of Rights was repealed to allow greater public scrutiny of police action. Maryland has the oldest statute on law enforcement Bill of Rights. So, in fact, this is a tectonic shift. As the news of the new police reform bills were making its way, in Tacoma Park, an off-duty Pentagon police officer shot and killed two men. The details are still emerging, but the officer claims the men were car thieves and they fled from his command to stop. Why anyone would not flee from a command to stop by another person in the middle of the night is unclear. Vigilante justice has been part of the larger problem of policing violence against Black men, women, and children. On April 6th, at Montgomery County Council hearing, Police Chief Marcus Jones and MCPS Superintendent Jack Smith answered questions about the mistreatment of the five-year-old student at East Silver Spring in January 2020. Chief Jones pushed back against the criticism that the department had been slow in investigating the case and took over a year to release the controversial body cam footage. Jones argued that the department followed its process and caseloads of internal affairs investigators could not have allowed a faster outcome. But he also mentioned that since the police officers themselves were African Americans, he was sensitive to the criticism that Black police officers were too often hung out to dry, and he didn't want that kind of discrimination in his department. The hearing saw both Chief Jones and Superintendent Smith evade questions about existing protocol between MCPS and the police department while promising to work on a protocol for the future. Councilmember Sidney Katz had asked why the child remained in police custody even after he was brought back to school, why MCPS and MCPD do not already have a protocol for this is perplexing. At a press conference, Mayor of Greenbelt, Colin Byrd, ripped into Maryland Governor Larry Hogan for inadequate pandemic response and vaccine rollout, perhaps the most critical of local leaders to do so openly. Montgomery County Executive Mark Elrich and Governor Hogan have long had a testy relationship, but at the opening of the mass vaccination site at Montgomery College in Germantown, they shook hands, the first public shake for the governor apparently since the pandemic. Between April and June 2021, the county's Department of Transportation is going to sweep over 4,000 miles of neighborhood streets, prioritizing areas close to sensitive watersheds. Last year, sweeping crews collected over 1,000 tons of debris. Yes, 1,000 tons. You can find the sweeping schedule on the Montgomery County Department of Transportation's website. If you see sweeping signs, move your cars to the driveway or another place if you can. Not sure what residents can do if moving cars is not practical, but try calling 311. I'll be back with Dan. Dan Reed, welcome to I Hate Politics.
Thanks so much for having me.
I think of Montgomery County as this Tocquevillian paradise, densely networked with civic associations and neighborhood groups and PTAs and nonprofits. How do you see it?
That's, I think, a good description of it. One thing that I do value, you know, from growing up here and experiencing it also as an adult, is that people, to some extent, are pretty engaged in what's going on around them, whether it's being very focused on the national level, because a lot of folks do work at the national level, federal government, or being really, really engaged on local issues. I think in a way that I work in communities all over the country as an urban planner, I don't always see that kind of engagement, which is both a blessing and a curse.
That's interesting. I was talking recently to Hans Riemer, the county council member, and he said that Montgomery County political leaders didn't get that kind of public interaction on social media, for example. He compared himself to Brandon Scott, the mayor of Baltimore, who puts out a tweet and he'll get 700 responses. Nothing like that happens in Montgomery County. So at least he has a different point of view.
I think it depends. I think it depends on the personality. It depends on the medium. I have gotten into some pretty awful Facebook threads on elected officials or appointed officials pages. So some people are talking. I do think that sometimes the inside baseball appearance of things might make it hard for civilians, if you will, to get involved.
So you grew up in Montgomery County. How have you seen neighborhood associations change, evolve over time?
Well, to be honest, I didn't really experience them growing up because my parents were part of one. They lived later on in a homeowners association, so I was, you know, aware of that. I think we are seeing over the past 10 years a very slow evolution from neighborhood associations using their role to fight or block change to being something else. And I think that's an important distinction to make because, you know, historically, neighborhood associations in Montgomery County and in other places around the country were often founded for exclusionary purposes. Whole system of policies in the early 20th century designed to make suburban neighborhoods exclusive and segregated. Racial covenants, single family zoning was one, redlining was another. And the neighborhood association emerges as like another part of that to ensure that the right kind of things are built in a community, which for much of the 20th century meant keeping out industrial uses, keeping out apartments. I found doing research here in Silver Spring throughout the 1930s, there was a big effort to block corner stores from opening in many neighborhoods because they were perceived as a cause of moral rot. That is a quote from like a 1936 Washington Post article about Erder's Market, which, if you're familiar with it, is next door to Silver Spring International Middle School and has been in existence for like 70 or 80 years.
So in Montgomery County, our neighborhood associations hold a important political position, right? They hold a lot of political power. Do you think that has changed? You talked about evolution.
I would call it the sort of smallest form of organizing in the county, not necessarily government, because neighborhood associations do not control policy, but they have a lot of influence in it. You know, traditionally, they get extra time to speak at public hearings. Elected officials give them extra deference if a neighborhood association speaks out on an issue because it is perceived that the association speaks for X number of people in a community. That influence, I think, is starting to wane, partially as an older generation of civic and neighborhood activists moves along as they age. And I think people who are, you know, active in the county today or moving to the county today just have different expectations of what this place is and how they want to engage with a community. And, you know, the traditional suburban neighborhood association, which was, you know, intended for coffee clutches and keeping apartment buildings out, isn't necessarily appealing anymore to people.
What do you think is happening? What does it look like now?
I think in some neighborhoods, it looks like neighborhood associations is literally dying out. Like there are people who are not rising up to take their place. And in other communities, you see, I think, more of a transition to neighborhood associations that focus more on social events, building community ties, and maybe taking a more proactive stand on what they would like to see in a place as opposed to what they don't want to see. One of the best examples in the county is there was on Randolph Road near 355 is a neighborhood called Randolph Civic Association, which is adjacent to the like White Flint area. And about 15 years ago, there was a large effort in the county to redevelop that area, create a vision for development around the White Flint Metro. And there was a tremendous amount of like very local organizing happening on behalf of some of the developers in that area to get people excited for the vision for this new urban town center area around the metro. And the Randolph Civic Association being adjacent to it was sort of ground zero in that, except the leadership of that organization was generally not interested in any development occurring around them. So in around 2010, a group of residents basically formed a slate and overthrew the board of the Civic Association and replaced them with a group of folks who were actually very interested and excited for new urban town center next to them. And then Randolph Civic Association actually pulled out of the Montgomery County Civic Federation, which is sort of the umbrella group for all the civics in the county. It was founded in the 1920s to block a railroad from being built, and for a long time was seen as like the marquee voice of neighborhoods in Montgomery County. And it was a big deal that a large civic association would leave the Civic Federation. And the reasoning was, we don't see it being valuable to be part of something that always says no to everything. That was about 10 years ago. And I think that sort of marked a shift for me in how neighborhood associations work here.
Now, you mentioned the Civic Federation. That's quite also a powerful body. Has that been weakened in your view?
I think it is not as influential as it used to be. There is a whole cohort of civic activists who came up through that organization for many, many years. And it is unclear, not just for the Civic Fed, but the county as a whole, who necessarily is stepping up to replace that group of people who generally say are in their 60s and 70s now.
I have thought about neighborhood associations, HOAs, PTAs as being in the same conceptual category. Do you find them different or do you find them similar in the way that they operate?
I don't have kids yet, so I'm not as familiar with how PTAs run from a personal level, but you know, my impression is they do very similar things, right? They are meant to engage people in the community, however it's defined, whether it's a school or a neighborhood. They intend to advocate or to share concerns that those organizations have, the membership, to the powers that be. And they also, I think, are both examples of like little p politics in that, you know, there are not necessarily elected officials or capital P politicians or parties in these organizations, but there are perhaps strong personalities, factions, differences of opinion, and all of the little like exchanges that can happen to sort of have a democracy, albeit at a very small level.
Sure. Are you a member of a neighborhood association now?
I am. I'm the planning, zoning, and public works chair for my neighborhood association.
Well, congratulations.
Thank you.
Can you talk to the small p politics that are involved in that?
I think in any group of people, you have strong personalities. You have folks who present as experts, whether, you know, sometimes because they are, sometimes because they are not, but are just good at playing a role. And I'm not speaking to anyone in particular here, but, you know, people, I think, gravitate to that. You want to learn about what's happening in Congress. You want to learn about what's happening at the state level, or even sometimes the county level. It's fairly easy to find that information at the neighborhood level or the school level. It's a lot more difficult to really plug in and understand what's going on. So if within that vacuum, if somebody can fill it and say, this is what's happening, or this is a thing you need to care about, people gravitate towards that. And that's what politics looks like, right? Like building a constituency. And like all things, it can be used for good or it can be used for other things.
Right. But it's interesting, right? The democratic theory, basic democratic theory, says that the closer government is to the people, the better informed the people are about that government. So in that way, the PTA or the HOA, neighborhood association, is the closest thing to the people. But you're saying that there's a dearth of information about the democratic body that is closest to the people, that is essentially goes against the old theory of democracy.
I think so. I mean, I don't know how the ancient Greeks or Romans got their local news.
Mostly through gossip, I believe, which I think still is what it is. Do you think the problem though is with the lack of participation, that people are not participating in those bodies, and therefore it's hard for people that do not participate then to find out about what's going on in those bodies, and so it creates this problem?
Yeah, I mean, I think the challenge with neighborhood associations here, but in lots of other places too, is, you know, defining who is in the neighborhood. My neighborhood association has boundaries; they're fairly broad, and within it is a community that is like 2/3 renters and 2/3 non-white. In general, the membership of the association and who comes to the meetings are almost exclusively white homeowners,
and older.
Generally, that's starting to change too. So even though we've incorporated all these things in the community, are we necessarily doing the outreach necessary to engage this like other 2/3 of the neighborhood that is somehow not able to connect with the association, right?
Right.
This is the very smallest level of what is a broader problem, right? Is how do you get people to care about democracy, to go and vote and participate and become informed and what have you?
So there's a difference between who makes up the neighborhood and the organizations that represent and speak for that community.
It is to me like the central struggle for me of like my neighborhood association or just any neighborhood association is like, how do you get people to care about this? It almost feels more difficult to get somebody to care about this like little thing than is for the big broader issues, right? Even though, you know, Joe Biden isn't picking up trash on your street, folks, it's difficult to explain to people why you should care about what your neighborhood association is doing.
Have you thought about why?
I think a big part of it is what your association cares about, and whether you plug into that, right? I'm going to switch to a different example. Is, you know, the PTA at my brother's high school. My brother has since graduated high school.
Sure.
The PTA at the high school primarily seemed to care about bake sales, booster club, you know, fundraising kinds of things.
Correct.
If you were interested in anything that was not those things, this organization did not have anything for you, right? And that alone becomes exclusionary, right? If you aren't connecting to what people actually care about. If a neighborhood association is primarily concerned with the whims of affluent older white homeowners, it is no surprise that people who do not fit into one of those four buckets might not find a reason to care about it. Why do I care about my property values if I'm a renter? Like, why do I care about things that could threaten my quote unquote property values if I rent, or don't feel like I can afford a house in this neighborhood anyway? You know, so there's a mismatch.
I had an interesting discussion recently when I was trying to get a PTA leader to come on the show to talk about how PTAs navigate differences between parents on various issues. Could it be boundaries, or could be reopening, or the SROs, or whatever, right? I mean, and how do you navigate? So she said, being the podcast has politics in the name and the PTA is supposed to stay out of politics, she can't do it. There is an underlying attitude, I think, that separates public policy, if you will, or public service, and certainly public education, as if it stands outside of the political realm. And again, as a political scientist, it's very difficult for me to sort of wrap my head around the idea that something public is not political. Have you seen that? Have you experienced that?
I tend to agree with you that everything is political, right? Like everything you do or say has implications for other people because we live in a society. And so there's a political slant to everything. And it may often be like little p politics, right?
Make that distinction. Make the distinction between little p and the...
When I think of big P politics, I think of political parties. I think of, you know, traditional like elected officials. I think of even within the party, you know, there's different factions of a party, right? Little p politics, I think of just the way people engage in any kind of organization or society, right? We talk about office politics, for instance, right? Yeah. There are no political parties in an office, but, you know who has more influence. You know who prefers who, you know who the different groups and cliques are within that organization, and how they interact with each other, how you have to present an idea to somebody to get them to like it, or who you have to talk to make something happen isn't necessarily the person who is in charge, right? But the person who influences the person in charge. Those are all forms of politics.
Right.
And you see that in these, you know, theoretically nonpartisan groups like PTAs and neighborhood associations.
We'll be right back. This claim of political neutrality is an interesting power play, actually. It's the people that are controlling these many of these groups that will say, oh, we are politically neutral. My thinking was that if we accept the political nature of these organizations and what they are doing, then it keeps everybody, you know, makes everybody aware of what is, you know, what the real nature of the game is, rather than this pretension of neutrality under which all kinds of political agendas are pushed forward, right?
No, totally. And that's I think, something that neighborhood associations have traditionally used to their advantage, right? Like if they are sort of this neutral, like we are just the voice of some people who live within this community, and this is what they think, right? Here is the one singular voice. And the problem with that is like, it's impossible, right? If you have 500 or 1,000 people living in a place, like they will not agree on something, everything, right? You know, one thing I've tried to do in our neighborhood association is to push the idea that like, we do not take positions necessarily on like controversial issues, particularly land use issues, which is mm-hmm. one of the primary things that neighborhood associations here engage on, because everyone's not going to agree. But also the idea that a neutral organization is going to say that we speak for everyone with one voice, and this is the position, is itself not neutral.
Correct. And neutrality is a position of privilege. It's a position of defending the status quo. So if you're an organization wanting change, then you're defeated by the position of neutrality.
And it turns people off. If the goal, you know, obviously associations can have different goals, but if a goal is to create something that people want to get involved with, you know, saying, well, this is our position on this thing, not to say you can't have positions on anything, but if the position is, for example, we are only interested in things that protect our property values, like that itself will turn off some people, because that's either not what their incentive is, or it doesn't align with their interests, or anything. Maybe not necessarily they don't want higher property values, but like that's not what motivates them to be a part of the thing. So why is that a position you would take?
That's interesting, because at some point that was the consensus, right? That a neighborhood association was going to defend property prices. But even that consensus was presumably manufactured at that time, and people were excluded from that consensus. Is that your understanding from the study of
this? Yeah, I mean, I think there's a social component. There always has been a social component to neighborhood associations as well. But like the political component is we're going to use this collective power of the people living within this shape to push for things that we feel are beneficial and not detrimental to the community. But it also came with a very specific idea of what is good for this place, which is generally things that make it more exclusive and protect the physical character of the place from changing.
So the political scientist, Robert Putnam, in Bowling Alone, he talks about the good side of social capital, which is what I think underlies your arguments, but also the really dark side of social capital, you know, and he talks about terrorist organizations and all of that, but you can do good and you can do harm. Mm-hmm. Can you speak to that?
If you have the ability to get people behind you, right, you have a force that can be moved in lots of different directions. You can use it to organize people for positive change or you know, get them to oppose something, right?
Right.
And it can create inherently inequitable outcomes. You know, a great example is in budget season, which is going to happen very soon at the county council level. A lot of the PTAs in wealthier school catchments, you know, that have a lot of time on their hands and resources will show up en masse to the public hearing, oftentimes wearing matching t-shirts, it's very common, to advocate for their thing, whatever they want the county to fund at their school. Right. There are other schools that don't have very strong PTAs, or may not have PTAs at all, simply because people don't have the time or the resources. They just don't, they're less affluent communities. And they have nobody speaking for them, essentially. And so the council, you know, assuming what this is what people want because we heard from them the most, will direct resources to that, you know, the squeaky wheel. Which ultimately produces an outcome where more affluent parts of the county, more affluent school catchments get lots of money for additions or for programming or for whatever, and less affluent communities that aren't able to speak up wait, essentially.
Yeah, and you know, I've been thinking about the solutions to these problems as well. I mean, as you might imagine, over a number of years, have you thought of some solutions? What could be done sort of in the near term and the longer term about how to fix that fundamental problem that some parts of the country, county are better organized and others are not, just by resources?
I used to think for a long time that part of the answer was just to organize people and to figure out ways to get people in these sort of less advantaged places involved into like the existing system. And over time, I realized that like the incentives just aren't there. People's time is limited. People have, you know, limited funding or means or different, you know, competing things in their lives. It's also really hard to participate in the traditional process as it is, right?
Sure.
All the public hearings are in Rockville. You know, people live not close to that. Like, it's a right. hassle to go to a place. Mm-hmm. It takes a certain relationship to power to stand right. in front of this elected body and give public testimony. It's intimidating. Mm-hmm. It is, whether you're shy or whether you're from, you know, you feel that you can't speak to power, or you're from a culture where that's not, you know, how you make decisions, how you get things done. So increasingly, I'm starting to wonder, like, well, how should the process look different? And how should the incentives be changed to get people to engage on the level that they need to be engaged?
Okay, so what are those things?
Working on that. as an urban planner, you know, a lot of my job is running public meetings and getting people to care about things so I can get their feedback on things. Sure. And ironically, one thing that has come as a surprise to me is that virtual meetings have been actually a really useful tool for that. I worked on a project over the past year in Baltimore City where we were trying to engage people on basically a manual that would help the city redesign streets to be safer for people. It's called Complete mm-hmm. Streets. And initially we started with, we're going to go to places in disadvantaged parts of the city where people are already going, to meet them there in their own time mm-hmm. in their own place. To meet with them, right? We went to the city's public markets, we went to farmers markets and community meetings and things like that. Then the pandemic started. We couldn't go to those physical places anymore. So we started doing meetings on Zoom. And crucially, we chose to partner with existing community organizations, social services groups, and community leaders. And those folks had already been organizing meetings on Zoom. So a couple of things happened. They legitimized the platform for virtual meetings. They also, by inviting us into their space, legitimized us sure. as credible people who can help you or give you, help with things. And one thing that dawned on me is, we were engaging, historically Black parts of the city, historically low-income parts of the city, and also the people living with disabilities mm-hmm. And senior citizens, all of which are, constituencies who may not have access to transportation, may not feel comfortable speaking to power in the traditional, like going to a big room and speaking in front of people, may have all sorts of things that like prevent them from participating, right? Childcare, food, time, bus fare, the ability to move around the city freely because you are living with a disability. And Zoom flattened all of those barriers. If you have a computer with an internet connection or a smartphone, you could participate from the comfort of your own home. You could turn your camera off and speak up without people having to see you and present in that way. Obviously, the digital divide is still very real.
Right.
But it was remarkable to see that we were actually getting more input from a more diverse swath of people than we had even by going to the physical places in neighborhoods. And that to me seems like a little spark of how things could be more equitable.
So let me ask you this. You go to an existing organization's sort of network, but in return for getting that access, is there an argument, is there a demand made that you might have to change your objective in the first place? So in return for access, they demand that you incorporate some of their own issues. How does that happen?
Yeah, I mean, I think you have to be responsive to that. One thing that we discovered throughout the process of working on this project is that when we as professional transportation planners talked about safety, we were thinking about people getting hit by cars, right? And like speeding. What many folks were thinking of were streetlights, potholes, crime, right?
Right.
So like that little tweak right there, like just introducing people to the idea of the thing. It's not, oh, we're really interested in creating safer bike facilities. It's, yeah, we want to help you get more streetlights on your street, or sort of broader idea of, we don't even understand how transportation works in the city and how to make our concerns heard. So that's like the first step. Like, we're here to help you understand how it works. So then you can bring your concerns and your questions forward to the city.
Have you tried this approach at all in Montgomery County? I mean, have you and said that, oh, let's move this all to digital and maybe it will improve participation and feedback?
Not yet. I mean, I've spoken at a bunch of virtual events, but it's still in some ways a work in progress. I mean, we're still, I think all of us, it's been a year since all this started. I think we're still figuring out how to do this the first time. And the question, I think, when things start to reopen is going to be, how do virtual meetings fit into that? And when can they be used? And when are they most effective?
Do you have an answer?
No.
Okay.
Not yet.
All right. That's good. Well, thank you very much, Dan. I hope you'll come back and tell us what you find.
Absolutely.
You know, both in terms of organizing and organizing on, digital media. I think it'll be fascinating to learn what you find.
Yeah. Thank you so much for having me.
What lessons should we draw from my conversation with Dan Reed? First, while American communities have changed in character, the organizations that speak for them, neighborhood associations, HOAs, PTAs, have been slow to change, creating a chicken and egg dilemma. The neighborhood organization represents the interests of a small group of people who control them. And because they do not represent the broader interests of a changing community, new community members do not participate in the organization, and the old people and their old interests continue to perpetuate. Rather than Robert Putnam's view that an exogenous technological shock of television led to the decline in American associational life, the problem here seems to lie deeply in the unrepresentative nature of the organizations themselves. While a neighborhood association will see wholesale change every once in a while, most change comes generationally. As the German scientist Max Planck once observed, and I'll mangle his quote, but here it is: a new truth does not triumph by convincing its opponents and making them see the light, but rather because its opponents eventually die and a new generation grows up that is familiar with it. Second, contrary to democratic theory that government closest to the people is always the best, it turns out government closest to the people is where people know the least. It is easier to find out enough details of the new infrastructure bill to say that you like it or you don't. But the knowledge of how to get a zoning variance, a sidewalk in your neighborhood, or the change of school assignment process to get the outcome you want, that's practically priceless. And by that I mean to learn it, you have to go do it. Get frustrated, become upset, and then after spending all that valuable time, you may or may not prevail. Neighborhood associations, HOAs, PTAs, fill this information hole, sometimes with good information and sometimes with bad information, but always with information that those who run the organizations want you to have. And that serves to keep the same people or the same set of people in positions of power for long periods of time in volunteer organizations. Third, just because a neighborhood organization is not supposed to side with the Democratic or Republican Party, that is, be partisan, does not mean that they are not inherently political. The claim of political neutrality in a volunteer organization is an assertion of privilege. It says, I control the agenda and you don't. It denies political agencies to those less powerful, and particularly to newcomers. Lastly, Zoom meetings could be better than commuting to face-to-face meetings, only to be met with the trappings of power of sitting in a grand hall and have people look down at you from a dais. Better to turn the camera off and read a written speech. I'll be back with Andrew Sondry and his upcoming. Hey, Andrew, how are things up county?
Good. Thanks for asking, Sunil. This week, I wanted to talk about communal identity and placemaking in the up county. because folks in Silver Spring and Bethesda know that they're from Silver Spring or Bethesda, but Germantowners and residents of Clarksburg tend to have a much less solid sense of what it means to be from Germantown or Clarksburg.
What do you mean by placemaking?
So I tend to think of placemaking as one of two ways that a community unites and forms a collective identity, the other being a common cause. Placemaking broadly refers to the creation or management of public spaces that foster shared experiences, either because the place is so unique and recognizable that you can't really escape it going about your day-to-day life, or because you and your neighbors and other members of your community spend a lot of time there. The clearest examples of this are town centers, but other examples include theaters, museums, parks, monuments or memorials, and some historic sites. Really anywhere that a community gets together to share in some activity.
Well, we know about the controversy in Clarksburg over the town center, but other parts of Upcountry also have town centers, Germantown, Poolsville, Gaithersburg. What's going on there?
Yeah, that's true. And Poolsville and Gaithersburg, of course, have a bit of a different experience. But in most of the Upcountry, communal life is a little bit more spread out. Both homes and resources that people go to on a day-to-day basis, like stores, schools, businesses, are much less accessible by transit or foot. So few of the events that people do together are in these places, and events that are in these places tend to draw smaller crowds.
Why are Gaithersburg and Poolsville exceptional?
I think both Gaithersburg and Poolsville have a stronger sense of community than most other parts of the Upcountry, due in part to the fact that they have city and town governments, respectively, to foster that. These local governments do all sorts of events and campaigns that increase social solidarity and make people more aware that they're part of something bigger than themselves.
Is the problem that most parts of the Upcountry are simply unincorporated, or could it be that these communities are just too large and spread out?
All of that certainly poses challenges, but I don't think any of it's prohibitive. So Silver Spring has a relatively large population and no city government, and Bethesda is fairly spread out, but both of those have a strong sense of place. I think the solution here is better planning and more communal events. We need safer sidewalks, more public transit, more parks, centralized communal amenities that is, you know, surrounded by housing, historic sites that are accessible to the public as museums or arts venues, more public art, outdoor performances, and events that draw people together. The more unique and representative of local life that these things are, the better. And you don't necessarily need a small, tight-knit community or a local government to do those things. They just help.
Yes, certainly after COVID. But really, if communal life is not cohesive, if the community itself is not cohesive, then what do you do? You know, the political scientist Robert Putnam theorized that although increasing diversity can be a benefit in the long term, it can cause isolation among residents of a community in the short term. As Upcountry is growing so rapidly with immigration really from all over the world, isn't it natural that it'll be harder to form a sense of community?
No, I don't think so. There are plenty of diverse regions with a shared communal identity and plenty of ways to bring diverse peoples into one. It might take time, but creating spaces and events that recognize and celebrate our multicultural character is the way forward. We're actually doing a really great job of this kind of thing in our schools. But what we need to do is we need to build that out into the community and bring more adults into the fold and create public events like festivals and parades and stuff for people of all ages.
You mentioned earlier that a common cause is another way to foster community. Do you think the fight over redistricting, particularly in Clarksburg, encouraged a greater sense of community there?
Not in a meaningful long-term way, no. It definitely brought together those people who were opposed to the boundary revisions, but that stance was more divisive, even just within Clarksburg, than it appeared from the outside. The move also failed to cut across a lot of the traditional class distinctions, drawing mostly from wealthier residents who were opposed to having more farm students in the schools. But it was also a pretty popular, the boundary revision was pretty popular among the students at those schools. So it was pretty divisive both inside and outside the community. But the problem with this issue as a unifying force is not only that it's divisive, but also that it's relatively short term. You're not going to have folks from across Clarksburg holding community events and social outings on the basis of opposition to the boundary study in 6 years, let alone 6 months.
Well, thanks, Andrew. I want to thank the guys at Ed's Not Dead podcast for pointing me to this journey into podcasting, and AJ Campbell for early help, including making the logo art. Our music comes from the local band Soul Witness. I'm very much looking forward to showcasing local talent and especially local music students on the podcast. If you want to share your music on the show or know someone who might want to do it, please email us at ihppod@gmail.com or reach out on Twitter at ihppod. I hope you will subscribe and share the podcast as we bring you stories about politics close to you and your home. See you next time. We'll be right back.